So it's an opportunity for our Saturday evening gathering together to reflect on Dharma, as usual. So practicing the Buddha's teaching, practicing the path that he's taught, and practicing meditation as part of that path is an essential part of that path, because what he's pointing to needs to be seen within ourselves. And as we know, the truths that the Buddha's pointing to are actually very fine truths, subtle truths. Not easy to see, such that, as is well known, as you well know, he hesitated in the beginning to even teach at all, because of what he realized, thinking this is a subtle and a fine truth. Who's going to understand it? So for us, when it comes to practicing the path, he did say it was a gradual training, and that insight, awakening, full understanding doesn't come all at once. So this in some ways is quite helpful for us, because I think sometimes part of our practice we can encounter frustration, because usually we begin the practice path with inspiration and aspiration in abundance. And we hear the teaching, something makes sense, and this promised fruit of full awakening, the ending of all suffering, is certainly something we can't resist, really. Who doesn't want to be free of all suffering, you know? It really is something that inspires us to test out this path, to make it work for us, and to see what the Buddha's pointing to. But as we encounter the various experiences in practice and in life in general, you know, it becomes more obvious that this perhaps isn't going to be as easy as we'd once hoped or thought. But there's different ways you can look at this, you know. The experience of frustration is really just an experience in the moment of a frustrated desire, really. So if we have this notion, if we have this idea of how my meditation should be, or how my experience should be, or a particular goal that you have in mind, that it should be like this, then whatever you encounter that doesn't meet that expectation will inspire frustration, will give rise to frustration or disappointment. So in this way you can see, and one of my early teachers often said, you know, the other side of inspiration is disillusionment or disappointment. You know, so it's good to see this duality, this pair. That in fact it's not just inspiration that's going to help us in this path. It's certainly helpful for bringing forth energy and applying oneself. But inevitably that inspiration peters out. And whether it takes 1 year or 2 years or 10 years or 20 years, or whether you go through periods of inspiration and disappointment, Just to begin to see that this is a pair in the mind. And the seeing of this is the Dhamma. The seeing that is Dhamma in itself. So this is where everything that we encounter on the path, in fact, is Dhamma. Everything that we encounter in our own minds now, in our own hearts, that we would otherwise judge as good or bad, or what we want or what we don't want, but all of it is Dhamma. And one of the big obstacles actually on the path has been articulated in terms of how we are conditioned to judge good and bad, right and wrong, and how that affects our desires and our likes and our dislikes, and how that affects the conditioned push-pull in our own minds, in our own experience, in relation to the things that come and go in our experience, in relation to the pleasant or painful experiences. So all of this becomes part and parcel of the path when we encounter it in meditation. So any state of mind, any emotion, any sensation, any thought, it's all Dhamma. As soon as we get that right perspective, we can turn it into Dhamma. From the perspective of right view, all of it is just the play of the khandhas. Yeah? Material form, feeling tone, vedana, perception, mental formations, sense consciousness. Everything we experience on the spectrum that we might otherwise judge as good, bad, right, wrong, what I want, what I don't want, the path, not the path, you know, delusion, wisdom, whatever we judge, but in fact all of it is Dhamma when seen with right view. So this is an important and extremely helpful aspect of right view to develop. How does it become right view when we see it for what it is? Through establishing mindfulness, just to know an experience for what it is seeing clearly. So the Buddha gives us these paradigms of an encouragement to reflect on our experience in terms of the five aggregates, the five khandhas. You know, whether the perception is a deeply disturbed or deluded perception, or whether it's a pleasant and likeable perception. It's just a perception. It's a memory or a mental label or an image arising in the mind. And as soon as we can recognize that, that's the wisdom mind that can recognize, oh, that's perception, that's the play of perception. And once the mind or mindfulness is poised to recognize that, we've established mindfulness, we've established right view, and the mind is poised to see that it arises and ceases. It comes and goes. Perception, feeling, mental formations, sense contact. It's very momentary. Physical sensations come and go. These are all conditioned, momentary, impermanent, changing experiences. And that's the very wisdom that the Buddha is pointing us to as being liberating wisdom. To see these experiences in this light, in this view, actually undermines our habitual clinging, our habitual assumption, our habitual delusion, which takes all of these things and turns them into a me and a mine and a what I am. So this fundamental articulation of delusion, or that which keeps us trapped in samsara, the Buddha says is, and when I say trapped in samsara, that's just cyclic suffering, whether you conceive of that as life after life or just, you know, hour after hour, this cyclic suffering. And when you're sitting meditation, you can certainly see how the mind cycles in old patterned thoughts, feelings, memories, mental constructions. And as soon as the mind assumes identity and ownership of that, we're stuck in this dualistic frame within our own minds, but this dualistic framework of self and other, me and the world, what I want, what I don't want, that whole dualistic framework comes into being as soon as we, or the habitual mode, the default mode of the mind, which is not yet fully awakened, not yet fully knowing or fully understanding, the default mode is identification, is clinging, is moving with the wanting and not wanting. So it's only really this development of wisdom through mindfulness, right view and the other path factors that begins to develop and see this perspective of these aggregates of experience, the five aggregates of existence, which are continually arising and ceasing, and within our meditative awareness we can discern these as they are. This is why the meditation is so important, because it's quite difficult in the flow of life when we are engaging with others and have jobs to do, and you know, it's quite difficult in the flow of life to keep a continuity of reflection or contemplation on the five aggregates. But in meditation, when we make things simple, just be still in the body, and whilst the mind might not be completely still, we can center ourselves in awareness and determine and practice observing the coming and going, the arising and ceasing of these aggregates. And if we can't yet observe it, then we develop, which is always a part for all of us, we develop the ability just to calm this body and mind enough, to calm it enough to begin to reflect, to have enough centeredness to begin to reflect on our experience. Form is those physical sensations which are a perpetual cascade of change. Sometimes in meditation when we can be aware of the body, but maybe you've got a sore shoulder and all the body is for you in that moment, or a few moments, or the whole hour, is this sore shoulder. You're not actually aware of much else but the sore shoulder. Now we assume the existence of the whole body, but actually you're focused on just this experience of the sore shoulder. So for you, the body in that moment, form, material aggregate, is just this pulsating, whatever you want to call it, pulsating pain or just sensations, throbbing. And you can even begin to discern, if you get concentrated enough, can begin to discern the different qualities of the four different elements, or even the five different elements within that. And for you in that moment of meditation, that's the experience of materiality, that's the experience of the form aggregate. It's only an idea that in that moment that says, well, I still have a head and two arms and two legs and a mouth and ears. That's just an idea of the body, but in the moment, form aggregate is just what is appearing in the mind, moment by moment. So this can become a really interesting investigation in itself, because as you pay attention to the body as it appears in consciousness, it really just appears in bits and pieces and parts, you know? And it's a cascade of different sensations. Maybe now you're aware of the head, and next few moments you're aware of the foot, and next few moments you're aware of the eardrum because there's a vibrating sound from a loud cockatoo. You know, just noticing this changeability, and noticing also that this, when our eyes are open and we look at bodies, we see, yes, we're complete in all these parts and it looks like this. But when you close your eyes, when you remove that visual consciousness, what is body? What is form aggregate in consciousness without the eye consciousness? It's merely sensation, a cascade of sensations which are in constant motion. So dropping the idea, you know, that very compounded, solidified, concretized idea of I am this body, the body that we see in the mirror or the body that we see others have. Imagine if you'd been born without the faculty of sight. You'd never seen, literally seen a body. How do you know a body without sight? Primarily you know it through tactile sensation. But that gives you a whole other sense of what the form aggregate is. And by contrast, when you think about that a little bit, contemplate that a little bit, you realize how conditioned our mind is through the visual consciousness, and particularly conditioned to identify self and other. Really splitting off. This is me in this particular frame, in this skin bag, as is a term from the Buddhist texts, the skin bag. And then that kind of concretizes the dualistic world. But the more time you spend in meditation, where you're really letting go of visual consciousness to a large degree, and observing the arising and ceasing of the aggregates as they appear from moment to moment, from present moment awareness. This is where we can discern the arising and ceasing of the aggregates. And this is really key to the Buddha's teaching on awakening. He said, you know, once we really comprehend that these five aggregates are anicca, they're impermanent. Once we really see them, discern them as being changeable, unreliable, that they're not productive of lasting happiness, even though a pleasant feeling might come with any different sense experience, that pleasure is not sustainable because the very conditions that it has given rise to it are changing. So we can't cling to pleasure, so that the definition of that in itself is dukkha, because even pleasure is not sustainable, it's not reliable. So once we understand this anicca, the changeability, the unsatisfactoriness of these aggregates, and we also see through to the not-self nature of these aggregates. The Buddha says once we see these things quite clearly, then the mind relinquishes its clinging. The mind kind of goes like, whoa, what am I even getting involved for? You know, something clarifies through wisdom and right view. And so the Buddha actually talks about this as a natural process. As much as it's a natural process for dukkha to arise through clinging, through hanging on to things, through the perversion of view, the thinking that something that's impermanent is actually permanent, that something that's actually dukkha or unsatisfactory is pleasant, and thinking that something that's not self is self. This is called the kind of perversion of perception. This is, even that is a natural process of what gives rise to dukkha. But as soon as we see things as they actually are, a term from the suttas, see these three characteristics of all conditioned existence. All conditioned existence is summed up within the five aggregates. Then it's a natural process for the heart, for the mind, to let go. Perhaps as easy as it would be to imagine if you picked up a hot coal from the fireplace, as soon as you comprehended that hanging on to it was what was causing the severe burning, the automatic response is to drop it. Or sticking your hand in a flame out of curiosity. When it burns, there's just this automatic pulling away. So the problem is in the perception, the distorted perception or the deluded assumptions or our thought processes that are fueled by ignorance. And ignorance is simply defined as not knowing, not comprehending the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha, its causes, how it comes to cessation. So the meditation with some degree of calm, and different teachers will teach on different ways, whether some teachers will focus on developing calm and stillness and samadhi more predominantly, while others will say just enough calm to give you the opportunity to observe and establish mindfulness and awareness, to see these processes for what they are. Of course, with samadhi, it's compared to, or one analogy is comparing it to the sharpening of a knife. If our samadhi or our level of calm or stillness has some depth to it, it's like using a sharp knife in the kitchen. So when you want to turn it to look at something, to investigate something, it kind of cuts through quite easily. It sees things more clearly. And this is because that with a degree of calm and stillness enough to be called samadhi, then the five hindrances, which are hindrances to concentration, hindrances to samadhi, are allayed, are suppressed or allayed. And so these five hindrances are talked about as actually the things which kick up the dust in the mind, prevent us from seeing clearly a lot of the time. So if we're, trying to see the aggregates and see the arising and ceasing while the mind is still really stirred, it's like using a blunt knife in the kitchen to chop a tomato. You don't quite get, it gets a bit messy and it's not as clear as it could be. So you can see the importance of developing some calm. But the danger too, as others, some teachers have talked about, is that we can get attached very easily to the pleasantness of calm and very conditioned to just letting the mind turn to its calming object and getting stuck there. So some teachers who are more proponents of insight will really say, let the mind, settle enough, but then let awareness be open and contemplate the different objects in the field of awareness with mindfulness as your stability. So I personally see the sense in both of these approaches, and I will tend to use both myself, but I usually respond to what's happening for me in any given moment. And certainly when one is struggling to settle the mind, one could perhaps just feel frustration for a long time. If you feel like your mind's restless or you're stirred up with something, if you have this idea that I've just got to, focus on the breath until the mind is peaceful, then that's definitely going to bring up frustration pretty quickly. So you actually have to engage your wisdom mind as well. You have to see that you have an idea of what you want and it's not happening. That's the cause for frustration. So let's use awareness right now. There's always mindfulness and awareness. There may not always be samadhi in its fullness, but there's always awareness. If you recollect that and just say, what's happening now? What's actually happening now? The mind is restless. There's a lot of thoughts moving through the mind. Or the body is restless. It feels like this. So what's happening there in this approach is we're using the approach of mindfulness, of vipassana if you like, investigation. But as you're doing that, it's helping to settle the mind because you're asking the right questions. What's happening now? And you recognize the Dharma of the moment. You recognize, the mind state has restlessness. Restlessness is the mind state right now. you're seeing Dhamma. You're seeing it as it is, you're seeing the truth of it. And when you do that, notice something stills around the restlessness. It's very interesting, or whatever, it could be desire. You might say, well, there's powerful desire in the mind right now. What you're doing is you're aligning with that first noble truth. You're making the experience of dukkha into a noble truth. You're establishing right view. You're seeing it. Ah, it's like this. So it's like you're zooming out. You're no longer fully identified, aware. There's enough awareness and mindfulness to recognize what's happening. We might label it restlessness or desire or aversion. We don't even have to use a label. It may just be, it feels like this. But what you're doing is you're turning your attention to recognize the mind state as the mind state, or to recognize the emotion as the emotion that's present, to recognize the sensation as the sensation. So what you're doing is you're recognizing the aggregates just for what they are. This is wisdom. So in my experience, this begins to still the mind through right view, through right effort, through right mindfulness, and these are all precursors of samadhi. So this you can talk about as developing samatha vipassana in tandem. So whether you start with the samatering, the calming, or you start with the inquiry, they usually can develop in tandem like this. Once the mind stills a little bit, even with the experience of restlessness or desire, what I find, what happens is, once I see Dhamma, once I see it as Dhamma, some of the dukkha drops out of it. When the dukkha drops out of it, I get more interested. And when I see it as Dhamma, I get more interested. So my energy is turning. And I you know, quite naturally now just start to cultivate that wholesome state of it's not clinging, it's knowing, or it's beginning that process of letting go, of resting back, seeing it as it is. And I notice my body starts to calm a bit more. And as you notice the calmness, the slight pleasantness of letting go, you tune into that and it allows the letting go even more, the calming even more. And then you just work with what is. If you're staying present with a sense of restlessness, you might notice how the restlessness begins to subside. Or if you're caffeine-fueled or sugar-fueled, you might notice just the rush of it. Like, oh, there's this constant rush. Can you maintain awareness? Can you maintain your mindfulness of that as a mind state? You know, that's really the crux of the Dhamma. Or you might be able to begin to watch yourself getting drawn into, watch the mind rather, getting drawn into a rehash of something happened earlier that day that may have upset you. So you can be aware of how the mind is being drawn into this whole storyline, and when you wake up, how it lets go for a bit. And how it gets pulled in and lets go, pulled in and lets go. So this is really important learning territory, because if we're maintaining awareness and mindfulness, you're really beginning to understand the Four Noble Truths in this process. So turning everything into Dhamma, or seeing everything as Dhamma, I find is the most enriching, effective way of practicing. And the more you do that, the more your mind, your heart, the more you begin to trust in resting into this present moment and just inquiring what's happening now. What's happening now? And trust this power of awareness, of mindfulness, that just knows things as they are. And of course, there's a lot of conditioned liking and not liking. We have the conditioned reaction to the, you know, a lot of the hindrances, they're always unpleasant. Those mind states are unpleasant. So we need to notice how the mind reacts to unpleasantness. We're noticing vedana, unpleasant vedana, pleasant Vedana, neutral Vedana, it's all just Vedana. It's all just the aggregate of Vedana. So we can know it just as Vedana. We can know the, if it's unpleasant, we can detect oftentimes a judgment, an internal judgment of it, a resistance, I don't like it. It may even give rise to more aversion because of this painful feeling. So being aware of that is really important. So just know unpleasant feeling is unpleasant feeling. And keep watching. Just keep watching. It's about learning. And we never really know when this path development, this is all path development, we can never know, we can never predict when it's going to pay off. When the penny is going to drop, when the insight will arise. So our work, and which the Buddha's, most of the Buddha's teachings were in regards to the path of practice. He sometimes talked about the goal in subtly inspiring words, but he didn't focus a lot on that. He wanted people to practice the path. That is what produces, well actually that's not quite true, it, because they talk about Nibbana is actually unproduced. It's already here and now to be seen. It's not caused by the path. Nibbana is a reality in and of itself. The path actually dispels delusion. The path dispels or lets the dust settle so as we can see what's there. It's probably quite a good way of thinking of practice. Yeah? Just let the dust settle. And there's that beautiful and simple metaphor of the water and the mud in the water. And say a glass of water, if it's stirred up, the mud clouds the water. So we can't, the water's not clear. We can't look into it and see our reflection, we can't see what's in the water, we can't look through it, through its transparency. But as soon as we just leave it alone, just let the mud settle, because it's its nature to settle, and the nature of water is clear, it separates out completely. Such that the water is now clear, you can look through it, it's completely transparent. If you're out in the sun or looking into a clear pond, you could see your reflection. You could look into a body of water and see what's there because it's clarified, it's separated out. All through just not stirring it up. Let it be. So in a way, you know, we could talk about the path as something like discovering what we're doing that keeps stirring things up. You know. And once we discover what we're doing that keeps stirring things up, just let it settle. No judgment, you don't have to annihilate or get rid of or destroy or push away. Just let be, let settle. This is another way you could talk about the Four Noble Truths, you know. Dukkha is the muddy water, and the cause of dukkha is what we're doing to stir it up, you know. So the path is just letting it be, letting it settle, so you can see clearly to realize the truth. So it's a simple way of thinking about it, but quite helpful because so much of our practice path, I think, we get into, as most of our life, most of our conditioning is we've got to do it, we've got to make it, we've got to build it, we've got to, you know, get rid of and hold on to, and that's not necessarily the most helpful way to think of it at all. Even though the Buddha did talk about right effort, this is a very subtle thing in when it comes to meditation. So right effort is always about, you know, bringing into being, allowing to come into being and maintaining what is skillful. And as I said at lunchtime, what is skillful is that which is for the benefit of oneself and others, that brings clarity, that brings well-being. Unskillful is that which brings dukkha for oneself and others, doesn't help one see nibbana, help one let go. So the effort of cultivating skillfulness and letting go of unskillfulness isn't really a lot of the doing energy so much as the wisdom to see the causes of dukkha within oneself and the causes for letting it all settle, letting it settle, letting it clear. So as I was saying just before, that you can never predict how and when this path is going to fruit. So it is important just to keep, you know, to let go of any concerns really about the fruit or the potential fruit in the future or the worry about where I'm at with it. But just keep returning to these simple but profound practices of establishing oneself in awareness here and now. Awareness is actually an inherent, always present quality. It's just that we lose sight of it, or we find ourselves off center in our doingness, in our chasing things, in our trying to fix things or get things. But when you remember awareness as that most essential quality of the awakened mind, of the Buddha mind, it's taking refuge in the Buddha, then you, it's really just this present moment here and now. It's the only place of awakening and the only place of practicing the path, the only place of seeing clearly the way things are. It's just a matter of perspective to see clearly, and it's a matter of just recognizing awareness that helps center you and give rise to that right view. And I was reading just the other day, I'd bought this to read to you, to share a lovely little poem from one of the bhikkhunis, one of the enlightened bhikkhunis. Patachara, you know, there's this tradition for the enlightened bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, they would often construct a poem, maybe a spontaneous gutta, which expressed something about their enlightenment. And sometimes it was at the moment of enlightenment or recollecting the moment. So this is Patachara. And it speaks to me, well, it spoke to me, and I thought it might speak to you as well, because she starts to articulate, you know, I'm practicing really well, but you know, why aren't I getting the fruit? Where, you know, when am I going to find the end of dukkha? You know. So she says, when they plough their lands and sow the earth with seed, nourishing wives and children, the lay folk gain rewards. I've cultivated virtue well, followed my teacher's rule. I'm not proud or lazy. Why haven't I found Nibbana? And then she goes to wash her feet at the end of the evening. She says, washing my feet, I watched the water flowing from high to low. My mind was concentrated, reined in like a noble stallion. Then taking up a lamp and entering my hut, I checked the bedding and sat down on the bed. Lifting a needle, I doused the burning wick with it. Like the departing flame, the heart was then released. So there's not a lot of bells and whistles or fanfare happening there, is there? Like just going through one's routine, washing your feet before getting into bed at night, checking your bed for spiders and insects, But her mind, she noted, her mind was steadied. And sometimes this steadiness of mind comes about just as a result of earlier practice. It doesn't mean you've been working right in that moment to get concentration, but sometimes at the end of a day of practice, the mind just starts to feel settled, or it's just not caught up in a lot of thinking, and you notice, oh, it feels quite steadied, present. You know, this is samadhi. And you maybe haven't worked for it in that hour, but it's a result of all your previous cultivation. And in this moment for her, you know, just going through that routine of dousing the wick on the lamp, probably a kerosene lamp or something, the heart was then released. And this is a particularly apt analogy, which is all through the suttas, relating the going out of a flame to the heart being released from the fires of greed, hatred and delusion, from samsara. And if you read Ajahn Tanisro's book, The Mind Like Fire Unbound, he talks a lot about the early Indian understanding of the physics of fire and how the metaphor of fire is used so consistently through the Buddha's teaching. Most often, the fire of greed, hatred and delusion, which traps beings in samsara. And when greed, hatred and delusion is let go of or seen through or dropped through non-clinging, through non-identification, then the experience of the heart released is talked about is like the flame going out. And this is where we get some potential confusion in the West, because the flame going out as a description for the realizing of Nibbana and one description of that being extinguishment or extinction, you know, it can lead to this notion of nihilism or annihilationism, that something is completely destroyed. But the metaphor in this early Indian context is the flame is released, because when the flame burns on its fuel, it's considered entrapped and agitated by the fuel. And when it's released through no more fuel, it returns to its latent elemental state, but it's released and freed from the agitation and the burning of that fuel. So it's a very beautiful analogy to come to understand the heart released. And one of the etymology of Nibbana actually means unbinding or unbound. So it's the unbinding of the heart. To realize Nibbana is the unbinding of the heart, or the releasing of the heart from dukkha, from suffering, from burning, from agitation. So this is a lovely example, this poem, of just what seems like an ordinary day and an ordinary routine, and even some frustration and self-doubt. But the path factors, as conditioned path factors, have their own momentum. And this is what we can't predict. So this is where we need the faith, just to continue to see the Dharma as Dharma in all of our experience, and trust that those path factors will come to fruition in their own time, just as the seed of a beautiful big eucalypt. You know, it started from a seed and it grew in its own way. Every eucalypt, every tree, every plant is so unique in its way of growing. It comes to fruition and fullness through its own time and with the supporting conditions in its own way. So this, in a way, we have to trust for ourselves. As long as we're cultivating the path, we're developing that skillfulness. And so trust in your inherent capacity to awaken, and that this will develop in its own time. Ananda, the Buddha's personal attendant for so many years, similarly was quite frustrated. He was a Sotapanna for a long time. Many of his brothers in the order were gaining full enlightenment, and he, traveling with the Buddha and being at so many teachings the Buddha gave directly and having direct contact with the Buddha, he wasn't yet fully enlightened. And even when the Buddha passed away, he wasn't yet fully enlightened. And he wanted desperately to understand the fullness of awakening before the first meeting of the arahants after the Buddha's death. So he practiced very, very hard, we're told, morning and night, until the night just before the arahants meeting, and he still hadn't realized full awakening. So what did he do? He thought, oh well, I may as well lie down and have a rest. And just as he was lying down, just before his head hit the pillow, he attained full awakening in that moment of letting go. So it's not that all his practice and effort was not to any benefit, but something came to fruition where his mind let go. Maybe just backed off on the accelerator, let go of his hopes and fears and ideas, and just moved into a more restful mode, and something completely dropped. The delusion, the final layers of delusion completely dropped away. So he would not have been able to predict it. So I think of these stories, and I find it's food for the heart. It nourishes the heart and certainly helps me continue, as I hope it does also for all of you. So I leave you with those words.